This feature has been brought to you by Slot Foundation, which needs your support to continue projects like these. Information on this recording and access to other recordings is available online at slot.org.
I assigned talking to strangers in my course last semester because I think even though it's a really a book of political theory and literary interpretation in many ways, it has a lot to say about what community development can be about if it is serious about making changes to the social contract. And the book is a meditation on how the body politic can be reconstructed through individual acts of citizenship and friendship, and then how that relates to the creation of institutions that support democracy and equity and trust. There's a lot in this book about trust. I wanted to really start out by asking Professor Allen to talk a little bit about how she became interested in writing the book Talking to Strangers. I mean, it's been a few years now. and it's, you know, this book involves analysis of photographs, events, and works of literature from the civil rights era, and in particular, a close political reading of Ralph Ellison's book, Invisible Man. So can you talk to that question of what motivated you to put this book together?
Sure. No, thanks a lot, Laura, and thank you, Aaron, both of you, for the invitation. It's a pleasure to be here, and I understand this is finals week, so for all of you who are affected by that, thanks a lot for taking time. I'm going to answer your question, but maybe what I'll do first is just say a little something about some of the purposes of the book and the ways in which, you know, how is it that somebody who's trained as a political philosopher can end up writing something that people in design find useful? Which has been one of the interesting experiences of the book, is that this is not the first conversation I've had in a design context. People have reached out and said, there's a resonance here. And as I've reflected on that, what I've come to think is that, you know, what the concept, the relevant concept, this will not come as a surprise, that connects the two spaces is design. That politics is about human intentionality and building their worlds. And design focuses, in some sense, on the physically built environment, but that work of architecture, building a world, is exactly the same as what political work is fundamentally about. So for me as a political philosopher, there are sort of two key questions. You know, one is, you know, what are you going to design and how are you going to design it? And so the what are you going to design question for me is a very easy one. It's egalitarian participatory democracy. And I don't really make any distinction between whether you're talking about how do you design political institutions, how do you design social habits and cultivate social habits, how do you design a curriculum in schools to generate that, how do you design the built environment. For me, those are all part of a single conversation or question. So then actually, I said, for me, that's the easy part. The hard part is the how part, you know, how to get from where we are, the world that we live in with all of its fractures and cleavages and divisions and so forth, to that kind of democratic vision that I sketched. And that's where, for me, the concept of distrust kicked in as a really powerful concept to understand because it's such an obstacle to actually achieving forward progress. So the story of how did I come to write the book is kind of lodged in some very personal discoveries about the issue of trust and distrust. So just tell you a little story, and this will maybe be a bit surprising as an origin story for the book, but I was an undergraduate at Princeton, having grown up in Southern California, and I grew up in a part of Southern California that in the 70s was really socioeconomically mixed and ethnically mixed. You can't say that about all parts of California now, but it still is a more hybrid culture than the East Coast, and where I grew up was a place where, you know, literally on the street, everybody greeted everybody. It didn't matter if you knew them or not. And I got to Princeton, and I was like the kid walking around campus going, hi, hi, hi. And there's like these stony faces, like everybody sort of walking past me, never acknowledging me. So that was sort of point one. I just kind of like didn't get it from a cultural point of view. I sort of started noodling over what that meant, what the consequences were. But then the consequences kind of came home to me late in my senior year. I was working on a senior thesis, actually probably about this time of year, now that I think about it, sort of been late at night in a computer cluster and was walking back to my dorm, and the building adjacent to mine from an upper story window, you know, at around midnight, I was sort of walked under a street lamp and somebody shouted, nigger, at me. which hadn't happened to me before. I had had my own share of unpleasant or difficult experiences, but I hadn't had that experience. And got back to my dorm room, and the weird thing about it was I didn't feel upset. I was like, well, I'm supposed to feel upset. Like, why don't I feel upset? The feeling that I had instead was a sort of loose tooth feeling, where you like keep wiggling the tooth to figure out like how does it actually feel, that like weird, like not quite painful, but like slightly weird, slightly uncomfortable feeling. And I realized that the reason I didn't feel worse was because at a fundamental level, I did trust my community and I felt safe in it. So even though I just had this very bad experience, it wasn't going to fundamentally destabilize my relationship to the community. And I realized that if, on the other hand, I didn't trust my community, that moment, I would have processed it completely differently. It would have been confirmation of the general threats that exist in my environment. It would have, you know, increased the difficulty that I would have had participating in the community, and so forth. And so I started to focus on that issue of the kind of difference trust and distrust make in terms of people's ability to participate. And then as a sort of scholar, I felt like, you know, political theory wasn't taking this into account, didn't have anything to say about it. And so I really wanted to bear down on that question of what can we do if we sort of start over in terms of our political thinking, our design thinking, by presuming distrust, then a part of the design process, politically or, you know, in the built environment, has to be about overcoming that. So then that was the sort of argument of the book, was sort of ways to think about how to overcome distrust across various, again, cleavages, divisions, and boundaries. So
I want to build upon that question and ask you to talk about it a bit further. I'm speaking here, I guess, in a curatorial kind of context, thinking about how one would choreograph or design or re-envisage opportunities for trust building, like right here where we're sitting, mm-hmm. on this linear mile of 10 blocks that takes us from Penn to West Philadelphia neighborhoods that struggle profoundly with different degrees of access and opportunity. And so I'm really interested in how your book would offer us and does offer us like very specific prescriptive mechanisms for, mm-hmm. for rebuilding trust. And I'm thinking of how like the very title kind of reminds us how we're habituated, as you say in the book at one point, to distrust a stranger.
Exactly.
And how as children, not just as adults, we are inculcated with this this sense of division and distrust and almost estrangement from those around us. And so I was interested if you could talk a little bit more about whether the book is not just an abstract commentary, but almost literally offering us like a methodology about loss, about sacrifice, about trust and distrust, and about, again, citizenship.
So, mm-hmm. No, thanks. That's a great question. I did intend the book in a fashion as a sort of how-to manual. In the first instance, it was a how-to manual for myself, because at the time that I was working on it, I was at the University of Chicago, south side of Chicago, a situation not unlike the situation at Penn, and I was really thinking about the relation between the university and the community and wanting to find my own way to a different way of being in that physical space. So I think there's sort of two parts to your question. One is like an exercise I put myself through about figuring out what to design, and then again the sort of techniques for moving forward with people who are strangers once you've decided that. The exercise is very similar to your linear mile exercise, which I love that connection. And so that's the book, in addition to drawing on Ellison, draws on Aristotle, of all people, who made the case that he has this whole list of virtues that human beings can acquire, and he describes one as an unnamed virtue. Nobody's ever been able to come up with a name for this thing. It's the virtue of interacting well with strangers, and it's a virtue that it's halfway between being domineering and being acquiescent. Like, you gotta hit that middle point for interacting with strangers. And he makes the argument that any city, so in his world, you know, city-state, needed to have that political virtue. It's something like friendship, he said, but it's not quite that because it doesn't involve the emotions of friendship. So I call this political friendship. And so I thought, okay, well, you know, Aristotle thought this was something that people could have at the level of a city-state. And modern political theorists, political philosophers will sort of poo-poo using Aristotle because, you know, this is a massive nation state, 300 million citizens. Like, how on earth does anything that pertains to a city relate to questions at that scale? And my sort of thought was, wow, actually, is that so right? Like, if I actually took the basic size Aristotle thought would work, 99,999 adults, that's the number of people that he thought you could be political friends with. And if I just drew a circle around myself and figured out how much territory that covered. You know, what would that mean? And I discovered it meant I would actually be interacting with a lot more people than I usually interact with, and involving them in my life and myself in their lives. So the linear mile idea is kind of similar to that. You take the circle and then you ask yourself this question of, what do we actually share in this world without realizing it? And there's a whole list of decisions that get made that define that environment that we share, in which people have different stakes. So I sort of focused on decision-making mechanisms and structures that affected that geographical region in the first place, and asked myself the question, okay, well, how can we redesign these? How can we build new decision-making, new planning structures that recognize the fact that we are all in this footprint together, we're all impacted in it together? And so then I had, like, you know, various design ideas, things I thought might work better. And so then the question is, you know, the trust question. How do you actually get people to participate in this? And so that is where the talking to strangers lessons come in. And the basic idea there is just, again, as Aaron suggested, you know, we're always lamenting our lack of a sort of civic education that teaches us how to be citizens with each other, but, you know, we have one, and it is, every time you tell a kid, you know, don't talk to strangers, you see those lessons all over the place. That is their civic education. So the thought was, we have to undo that and actually cultivate the capacity to talk to strangers, which is not, it's much easier said than done, right? And then, so you have to, you know, a fundamental part of being able to talk to strangers is being willing to be vulnerable in front of strangers. And getting to that point, getting over that hurdle in the first place, is one of the hardest parts of it. But then I think, you know, there's a lot of literature in rhetoric and other places that actually can help one understand what it takes to prove oneself trustworthy. Right? Because at the end of the day, building trust is about proving oneself trustworthy and giving other people opportunities to prove themselves trustworthy. And sort of doing it over and over again, taking knocks because it won't always work.
So I want to push you on this a little bit. So you also talk about sacrifice when you talk about trust. And you talk about how, particularly in an African-American context, but also for minorities more generally, often sacrifice is not voluntary. Mm-hmm. It's not honored. Mm-hmm. And it's not reciprocated. Mm-hmm. So how do you design in relation to something not just as abstract as trust or distrust, but something as historically embedded in the narrative of the United States as sacrifice, and a sacrifice that's unevenly distributed and, again, not voluntary, not honored, not acknowledged? So.
That is a terrific question. And let me start my answer with a very concrete suggestion, which is that there's a really interesting initiative at Lehigh University mm-hmm. called the Southside Initiative. I don't know if this has crossed your radar screen. But it's similarly sort of in this space that crosses design, cultural studies, political theory, democratic policy. And one of its major contributions, I think, to this conversation is to sort of pull historians into the work. So, because I was thinking, you take that linear mile, you survey it, you look for a collective, you know, decisions that get made and how do you rebuild decision-making structures. But you also have to look at the sort of untold histories of the place. And so what are the features of this area that make it good for some people that have come at a cost to other people? Mm-hmm. And you have to tell those stories and provide recognition for the costs that some people have endured, I think, as a sort of prelude to beginning to recirculate the distribution of, you know, benefits and burdens in the space. Mm-hmm. So to give you a very concrete example, when I was at the University of Chicago, the neighborhood immediately to the south of the campus is called Woodlawn. And when I started kind of doing community activism and so forth, I just kept picking up this story about how the university had burned the neighborhood down in order to take land. I was like, yeah, dude, like, there's just no way that can be right. Right? Like, how can you, and the university, like, had burned the neighborhood down? And I don't know about that, but that narrative was absolutely preventing people in Woodlawn from taking the university seriously about anything. And it took me a long time, but I finally figured out what the actual history was. And then I got it, and I understood both narratives, and then you could sort of start trying to reweave things. The actual narrative was that in the period of the late 60s and the early 70s, with the period of the Black Panther Party and so forth, and various sort of gangs at that time around the country did not mean what they mean now. They were not violent for the most part, or sort of low-level kind of criminal, you know, guys getting into fights, not organized crime, okay? So when you think gangs in the 60s and 70s, don't think organized crime. You think boys clubs that also got into trouble sometimes. Some boys clubs didn't even get into trouble. But in this period, some of these clubs start militarizing, you know, especially in the context of black nationalism and things like that. So there's more arms, it's not organized crime, but there's more arms circulating in these gangs in the 60s and 70s. The University of Chicago, company of sort of sociology or public policy, I can't remember which schools, secured grants to try to achieve a kind of demilitarization program. So they were gonna work with community churches, I think in Woodlawn, to buy weapons from members in the gangs. But at the same time that this was happening, property values were plummeting, and so there were homeowners who were setting their own homes on fire in order to get insurance payments, and some of the people doing that were also involved with these social service organizations that were trying to buy weapons off of people. So there was a circulation of money from the university into a community context where people were also burning their homes and collecting insurance payments, right? Okay, so you can get how that becomes a narrative of the university burning down the neighborhood. I mean, it's kind of complicated and so forth, but you had to actually excavate that history so that then you could, you know, the university could in some sense accept responsibility, though of a different kind than the university wanted to attribute it to it, and you could sort of start to reorganize people's narrative around the history. And then for the older neighbors who had stayed, who had tried to maintain homes sort of throughout the course of that period of time, you know, acknowledge their sacrifice and what they had put into trying to stabilize a neighborhood that was going through a heck of a lot of difficulty. They needed to be celebrated for their commitment and achievement.
Did that happen?
Not all of it, although, I mean, things that did happen are the university was building an art center right on that border, and when the plans, I guess like all these little things, when the plans started, I remember going to an early meeting where all of the university maps were oriented upside down, like south was at the top and north was at the bottom. And the main reason for this was because it sort of reflected a mindset of the university where that was like the limit to what they were going to consider. So it's hard to explain, but the point is just all the compass points were off kilter from how you would normally do a map because of the presumptions people had about what space they wanted to think about or not think about. So we got the maps reoriented. And then as the plans for the building were sort of moving along, we got to a point where people were willing to have a building that would have entrances on both sides. And a part of that was about reconnecting community members to the university and talking through the history with them. In a very sort of one-to-one way. So there wasn't a kind of public acknowledgement of everything, but there were lots of sort of local conversations.
I was struck by a comment you made a few minutes ago about what it takes to prove oneself trustworthy to somebody else. And that makes me think of the Invisible Man character who has put forth, repeatedly good faith efforts to be trustworthy,
right?
And has been met with, a lot of reasons to distrust. And I'm sort of curious about why he became kind of a lodestar for the book, because you know at the end of The Invisible Man, he's basically all by himself, alone in an underground kind of bunker that he has sort of arranged with, he's bathed in light that he's created, but he's essentially kind of completely isolated, mm-hmm. and it's this cycle of mistrust that has created that. So I guess you know if you were trying to prove yourself trustworthy to someone like him, mm-hmm. What do you think would be necessary?
That's a great question. There are two different ways to think about proving oneself trustworthy. I mean, there one is a sort of very easy in every interaction that you have on the street, in a store, you know, wherever you go, signaling goodwill, right? Actually engaging the person, making eye contact, and so forth. It's sort of like, you know, hi, I'm friendly kind of move. And that's worth something. I mean, this, nobody should ever knock that, because I think a lot of the basic texture of our lives relates to those very minute interactions. But for somebody whose distrust is just, you know, goes as deep as it's possible to go, I think that the only way to really crack that is to generate a decision, some kind of context for joint decision making, where something is going to be done, and it's going to be done together, and you're going to have to walk from the beginning to the end of that process, and then that process becomes the occasion for rebuilding trust. So, I mean, I could tell you another story, which is not a success story, that sort of is along these lines, which is there was a public park bordering on the university. It's one of the most, Olmsted Park, one of the most beautiful spaces in Chicago. Nobody from the university ever went into it because they were so deathly afraid of it. There were many ways of using it safely, but nobody was using it safely. And then there was a local community group that was responsible. Chicago had empowered community groups in each park to help sort of set policy for the park and so forth. There was an environmental problem with ponds in the park. And so I thought, and the woman who ran that park council was one of the most distrustful people I'd ever met. There was just no way she was going to collaborate with the university on anything. And so I thought, okay, well, they've got a problem with the environmental stuff. Let's build a structure to help them actually address that problem so that we can become partners with them in a piece of work they're trying to do. And we did eventually get the work done, get fish tested and so forth, confirm things, you know, get things to the information to the city and that kind of thing. But it took, I had a staff member working with me who got yelled at routinely at these meetings and would leave them in tears. And I would have to say, you know, I'm sorry, I know it's hard, we're going to go back and we're going to keep doing this. So did it, you know, did that build trust in the end? You know, a year later, she was more willing to collaborate. I couldn't tell you if that was a sort of fundamental human change or if that was just she'd realized she could get more out of it, sort of strategically speaking, than she had thought a year earlier. But at any rate.
That's interesting. Just so people know, there are a couple of seats in the front row. If you want to be a little closer to the...
I wanted to build upon all of these examples that you've been giving, which are examples that intertwine individuals and institutions. And one of the really moving and beautiful aspects to talking to strangers, I know it's so probably odd for us to constantly talk about talking to strangers when you've gone on for over a decade to do other work. But one of the really beautiful aspects of the book was the way you demystified what an institution is and what institutional change means and what it means to have agency in society, even as you say, democracy constantly strips us of agency. Mm-hmm. It empowers us to think we have total agency, but you say it also strips us of that agency at the same moment constantly. So in that complicated landscape, you outline how we could see ourselves still as having agency, as having institutional agency, mm-hmm. and as institutions not as something that is opposed to exterior to an individual, but also organically kind of emerging from how we choose to define and determine habits. And mm-hmm. So I was wondering, just kind of an open-ended question, could you talk a bit more about, again, institutional change and that relationship that you were trying to articulate between institutions and individuals, and what is that relationship?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. No, that's a great question. And I mean, I think, again, you know, I think the world of design is kind of a treasure trove of possible civic restoration for us generally, because I mean, the point of the world of design is that you reshape your environment, right? You have control over it. And so being able to share that lesson with people outside the world of design is really important. And again, I think like bringing, you know, really expanding the scope of things that count as design projects. Mm-hmm. And so I'm even thinking, you know, the world of design has done a lot for sustainability and environmentalism. And in terms of like educating partners, so somebody comes to an architect and wants to commission a building, the designer, the architects and so forth will be asking the person with the purse questions, right, about how are you thinking about sustainability in your building. So that's a kind of moment of education where the designer is educating the person who's in charge of the institution in the malleability of their own institution, the way they can even change basic practices, you know, add electricity meters that everybody can read in every room and so forth, and then you start changing the habits of people using the space. So it seems to me like, you know, there's a whole other raft of questions around who's at the table, the relationship of the institution to either equality enhancing effects or inequality producing effects, and sort of trying to get the owners of institutions to take responsibility for the choices that they're making as part of a design process. So I think, you know, the design metaphor is a very good one for kind of capturing the basic picture of agency.
But do you think of an institution just as a group of individuals? Do you think of, can you talk more about, you know?
Sure.
I don't know if I'm giving you a prompt, but yeah, that in particular, like how, what it would mean to talk about power in an institutional mm-hmm. context, and what it would mean to talk about change, and in particular in the context of the previous discussion where there's this like legacy of distrust often that right. prevents people from even feeling that they have any power in relationship to an institution. What I heard you proposing was that everybody has the power to institute, not just institutions, but also to change the habits through which institutions assert power.
I mean, there's one metaphor I use in the book for talking about the relation between individuals and institutions, and then there's another metaphor that I always have in my head, although it's not in the book. So the metaphor in the book is a snail with its shell, right? That our institutions are just the kind of concretized, coalesced products of our own lives. And so therefore, if we turn, our shell turns as well, right? If we sort of move along, we can change the shell. The idea behind that really is just that at the end of the day, I mean, you get an institution through processes of routinization. People routinize habits, policies, and so forth. They routinize roles, they routinize procedures, and institutions get built out of that process of routinization. But before you have routinization, you have habits, right? And before you have habits, you have individuals just trying to act in the world. So our collective habits are what gets routinized in institutions. So that's the sense in which I want to make the argument that even just changing at a basic level our habits of interaction flows through to our institutions. So for example, my most recent academic employer, Institute for Advanced Study, is a nearly all-white environment. I'm the only person of color there. So a couple of staff people, but nobody in the faculty or sort of scholarly ranks. And I do lots of other things in the world that are just much more diverse environments, like this one, for example. I should say my employee, I'm also the only one of two women on the faculty, right? So it's also all men. And so when I go from this space to that space, I feel the difference at an aesthetic level, and I can see the difference in the habits, behavioral habits, in those two places. None of my other colleagues, because they don't move in different spaces, can see those differences. But I know that if that place is going to change, it's going to have to change partly because habits that come out of spaces like this get imported into that space and sort of start to make people feel uncomfortable with the world that they're sitting in, such that they then change the kind of habits and policies that are leading to repetition of that over and over and over again. So that's sort of what I mean about the relationship between habits and institutions. The metaphor in my head, it's not in the book, is one about water and freezing. So that institutions are just frozen versions of our habits, basically, which are more fluid and malleable and, you know, open to us to reform.
You mentioned the scenario where a designer might educate a builder or an institutional representative about possibilities for sustainability. Mm-hmm. I think that's something that is a habit that's become pretty standard in schools of design and in the world that we inhabit here at Penn and in Penn Design. I'm wondering if you could talk about how one might do something similar to educate an institution about its malleability with respect to racism.
Mm-hmm. So I think in some sense all you really need to figure out there is what the right label is for that. And so now, do we want to take the accessibility word and expand accessibility? Or do we want to take something that's like a good neighbor word? Or do we want to take a sort of equality word? But in other words, I mean, I think in the same way that sustainability and accessibility with regard to disability have both, you know, best practices develop around those. There are organizations that certify, like this institution's doing well, this one's not doing well. You can build a similar kind of structure, or call it equity. You know, maybe that's the word for it. But getting institutions to ask themselves questions about, you know, who has access to the resources that we offer here? How much does our space affect who has access to these resources? So, you know, even at the level of public lectures, public programming, even in private institutions, there's a lot of public stuff that's not shared in an equal way. Or in an educational institution, you know, what are the ways in which what we're doing here in this building affects whether or not African Americans, Latinos, or people of color generally can get into this institution as students at some point down the road? I mean, one would have to work out exactly what the questions are to ask and what the kind of umbrella term is under which one's asking them, but I don't see why you couldn't. Right? Like, you know, we should get a table out and start doing brainstorming, because I think it's a collective set of, it's a collective project to figure out, well, what are the, take the list of questions you ask people about sustainability, take the list of questions you ask people about accessibility, what list of questions would we ask people about racial equity in relationship to the use of space?
But not just physical space, but also institutional space.
Yes, absolutely, yeah. I mean, so, here's another way to think about it. Another place these things come into contact with each other. So I'm on the board of Amherst College. Amherst has done a good job of achieving socioeconomic diversity. So among the kind of elite, fancy private colleges, it has the highest level of Pell Grant recipients and stuff like that. As also lots of ethnic diversity. We did this through financial aid structures and so forth. And it wasn't until we'd done it that we then realized that you can't close the campus over Thanksgiving any longer, because too many kids can't have nowhere to go, right? And so there's like a whole raft of institutional policies that have to change if you're gonna do right by a different population. So it's not just about entrance and accessibility, it is about use of space and time and so forth over the course of the year. So, you know, but there are a handful of places, University of Maryland, Baltimore County is another place that's done really well by diversity. You know, we should be asking them questions like, what are the design issues that have come out of their efforts to diversify their population?
And do you feel as a trustee that you were someone who educated that institution about its own malleability?
I've certainly tried. Yes, I've tried. That's a good question. Let's see. I think the interesting thing, so the college definitely has a good sense of its own malleability. I think the thing that's been harder for the college, and harder for me as well, so your question is really on point, is to really see all the places that need change, right? So you can kind of become convinced of your own agency and responsibility and still be undereducated with regard to where you should be applying your effort. And so that is, I think, something that we need, you know, collectively a lot more work and focus on. So your question about, you know, how would you help an institutional leader deal with problems of race and racism and so forth, it's a huge question, because I think there's just a big gap between even acquiring a commitment to do something and really having that kind of very fine-grained sense of where things need to be done to make a difference.
Interesting.
So. But it's a design problem. It's like, that's the brilliant
thing about it. An institutional design problem.
It's an institutional design problem. Yeah, but and it connects to, you know, built environment design mm-hmm. problems too. And so the design way of thinking is probably the thing we need in this conversation that we don't have in the conversation.
Good news.
So I have so many questions, but I want to throw out another comment or question that both Laura and I were really interested in hearing you talk more about. On page 105, you talk about, you're talking about Invisible Man and Ellison's protagonist, and you remark that he becomes increasingly aware that his willingness to put aside his personal desire for social equality in order to gain access to democracy's institutions of power has been abused. Mm-hmm. Right? So we've been talking about this desire to make society more equal and the way that we can do that as individuals within institutional contexts. But can you also talk about how that desire can also be abused by society? And I don't know if there's a simple question there. But.
Well, I mean, it gets back to the question of power again, which you asked and I didn't really answer, which is, you know, how does my story, what meaning does my story have in context of severe power disparities? I mean, so it's one thing to ask the powerful to, you know, prove yourself trustworthy because they can kind of go through the motions without, you know, making themselves vulnerable.
Yeah, they're not that vulnerable in that moment.
Exactly, right, there's a limit. And whereas to say that to people without power is, it sounds, you know, disempowering a second time over. That's what your question is really about. I mean, if somebody is trying to prove themselves trustworthy to people in power, isn't that just disempowering themselves a second time over? And I guess I have sort of a two-part answer to that question. So there's this, anyway, there's a moment in kind of political philosophy, which I think of as a sort of wave the white flag on the battlefield moment. And so that's sort of the first stage in this whole conversation about trustworthiness. It's worth waving the white flag on the battlefield because you'll find some white flags that you didn't know were there. So to some extent, you will make progress. You'll find some allies. You'll find some points of connection and be able to build on them. So what about all the other people who just take advantage of your having waved the white flag? What do you do about that? You know, I think that's a space for adversarial action and behavior. And so I don't want my story to discount social protest and social movements and that sort of thing. But I think a kind of a sorting process where you wave the white flag and figure out who's really ready to step into this trust-building game and who's not at all is really important. So that would be a partial answer.
So to be more strategic about how one shows one's displays one's vulnerability or uses one's vulnerability.
Well, I mean, you can't keep waving the white flag at the same person over and over again if they just keep refusing to reciprocate, right? So it's not. So my argument about proving yourself trustworthy is not about a sort of unending, you know, sort of abject relation. That's getting back to that virtue being halfway between being acquiescent and being domineering. You know, it's not about being domineering, but it's also not about being acquiescent. So, you know, give it three tries, and if you don't get anything, like, that's it. Basta, mental note, like, that person is not coming into this game, so we're going to have to use adversarial techniques instead. In order to, and sometimes that's a matter of, you know, finding an ally from their community who is willing to move into the game and getting that ally to help move them into the game. Sometimes there's a terrific book that you would be probably really interested in by a guy named Jeff Stout called Blessed Are the Organized, which is about how disempowered people can call people to power to account publicly, sort of strategies for doing that, and what it means for them to be called to account publicly. And that is that it can't, you know, again, it doesn't always work, but it can be a very transformative moment for those people who are in power and then make them more willing to engage in the game of trust generation.
Yeah, I wanted to ask whether you've had pushback on this work from people who kind of think of it as soft or want to go more immediately to the battlefield and to the adversarial process.
Absolutely, yes. I mean, so that's probably one of the biggest lines of pushback is exactly that, and that I sort of don't take enough account of structural features of inequality and the sort of work that you need to do at a policy level to, you know, redesign the macro, the biggest level structures in order to give people a kind of level playing field in the first place. And so my answer is basically that it's all complementary. So the fact that adversarial activity is necessary in some contexts doesn't make this other kind of activity less important. And in fact, my argument is, I mean, so if you, the pursuing social activism, protest, aggressive sort of agitprop techniques and that kind of thing, will itself achieve the most, have the most value against a backdrop where there are also other sort of healthy, trust-generating practices sort of in the work so that when there's an opening for change, there's a sort of context for, there's positive examples of the kind of world that you want to build and the kind of sets of relationships that you want to build. So,
shall we open it up, maybe?
We should just get to that one question that you kept coming back to about Ellison and this protagonist and what kind of agency this protagonist has.
I think I asked that one already.
You think asked it? Well, can I ask it then?
Sure. Okay.
So, we were reading some work of Martha Nussbaum's and Chang and other on Ellison and on Invisible Man, and what kind of agency this protagonist has, and whether this is a liberatory story in some sense or one just of domination and humiliation. And at one point, I think, if I'm remembering you as opposed to somebody else, that you suggest that he has agency through his criticism.
Mm-hmm.
And I was wondering if you could just speak briefly about, in this literary vein that is also so much a part of the book, you know, what kind of subjectivity he has and what kind of agency he has. Given how his struggle is such a struggle.
Mm-hmm. So there's a Philadelphia native who's a playwright named Chiara Legria-Hudes. Have you heard of her? She's a fantastic playwright. You guys should have her back. Mm-hmm. She's a Pulitzer Prize-winning playwright who won her Pulitzer at the age of like 32, which was the third time she'd been a finalist.
Wow.
Anyway, she's extraordinary. And I recently read a nice piece that she wrote. Where she talked about, I don't know if it's narrative equality or linguistic equality, something like that. But her point was just, again, we make our world based on what we know about our world, what we understand about our world. And so when our knowledge is partial because we don't hear some stories, then our building will be partial and reinforce inegalitarian work. So I take the invisible man speaking from his basement and telling this whole story it is a liberatory act, and it is about establishing a story as necessary that hasn't been part of the cultural landscape. You can see its impact in that, you know, the metaphor of invisibility, that it's with us everywhere. It's part of our basic language at this point. We use it to instantly identify a certain kind of problem. That is his gift to our culture, right? And it's made it possible for us to do various kinds of ethical thinking and reflection. So I don't take the story of Invisible Man to be one of domination at all. I mean, quite the contrary. I think it's a story of an individual who has secured a place in which he feels safe. It's an inadequate space, there's no question about that. But he's taken that inadequate space and he's figured out how to make it, to do something incredibly powerful from it. So in that regard, sort of triumphing over domination in order to achieve the fullest level of agency. And this is a place where, you know, I am... I'm a lover of poetry, I'm a lover of language. Shelley is the person who called poets the legislators of the world, right? And so so Invisible Man has achieved a status for himself as a legislator of the world, despite being confined to this teeny tiny little room with 1,369 light bulbs. I think that's the number of light bulbs in the room. But
should we open it up to questions?
Is that the right number of light bulbs? Does anybody remember?
I wish I had my copy here.
I'm going to check that one out.
Thank you for that conversation. So one of the questions I had when we were reading the book, and one of the conversations that we had in class, was about the concept of wholeness, not oneness.
Mm-hmm.
And I just wanted to see if you could explain a little bit more about how we would achieve wholeness versus the oneness that's proposed in the Constitution. And then the second question is more about... a lot of the conversation's been around building trust through face-to-face interaction, but today a lot of things are done online through social media and electronics. Mm-hmm. So how we can go about building that 99,999 person community through electronics and media as
mm-hmm.
well?
Yeah, those are a great set of questions. So on the second one first, so when I published Talking to Strangers in 2004, so giving lectures immediately before it and right after it, I got exactly three questions sort of over and over again, others as well, but three central ones. One was about structural issues and structural disempowerment and so forth and adversarial politics. The second one was about the relationship between my argument and undocumented members of a community and immigration. And the third question was about digital life experience. So I have a book, an edited volume coming out in June called From Voice to Influence, Understanding Citizenship in a Digital Age, which tries to answer that question in a digital context. So my basic conclusion was that the fundamental ethical analysis doesn't change, although one has to understand structure of agency differently in the digital environment. And the challenge, I think, is in the digital environment, we sort of think of it as a kind of ethics-free zone. And so we have to actually you know, work really hard to reestablish norms in that space. But it's a doable thing. And it is, again, I've actually developed design principles. In this case, I'm actually functioning as a designer to try to help people who are thinking about using the internet to build communities. Like, you know, what are some guidelines for how you would judge whether you were successful in what you were trying to do? On the wholeness question, so, I mean, there's a metaphor of health that buried in the etymology of the word wholeness. And so the switch from oneness to wholeness is to switch from a notion of unanimity as, or, you know, consensus as the thing that we're trying to achieve politically or socially, to a metaphor of health instead, social health and well-being. So what are the differences there? A big straightforward difference is that the wholeness concept has room for diversity in it. There's no effort to try to get rid of diversity or think that diversity is a problem. And it also forces one into a different way of measuring. So instead of saying, okay, there's a single standard that we want to apply across the whole sort of socio-political world for what counts as success, the wholeness measure sort of asks, you know, we have to look at every single part of the community and see, are they thriving? Are they healthy? And if not, why not? And then the answers to why, what it would take to achieve health in a metaphorical sense for any given part of the community may be different. So there's not a sort of single across the whole, you know, national landscape policy that you, in, you know, apply. You've got to sort of do the work of really mapping the whole landscape and figuring out what's the blockage to health over here, what's the blockage to health over here, what's the blockage to health over here, and then try to pull those pieces together.
Is this Ellison's conception of like a cross-racial brotherhood or not?
Well, yes, absolutely. I mean, so the result should be something like a cross-racial brotherhood, in the sense that you still have, you know, you love the diversity, you celebrate the diversity, but because there is a collective commitment to equal concern for all, and sort of health for all, I mean, that's where the brotherhood notion comes in. Even if the things that are necessary in one context to achieve health are different from the things that are necessary in another context. So you could still, you know, have a kind of overall notion of brotherhood across racial lines to frame that.
Hi, I really enjoy your metaphor of waving the white flag on the battlefield, but I'm thinking that that battlefield, those issues, at least in community development, are often very project-oriented. Mm-hmm. So there's a housing project, or there's a supermarket being built, or a park, or maybe there's an issue like Ferguson. So, like, you know, there, it seems to be kind of like an oriented quite specifically, but then at the same time, there's maybe another battlefield that's sort of these superstructures like mass incarceration or employment. Mm-hmm. You know, like, these are larger things, more ongoing. So I guess my question is, do you see these as like separate battlefields, or is it maybe the battle within the war, if we're going to extend this sort of military metaphor? But how
that's
do you
see
those interacting?
That's a terrific question. No, thank you. That's a great question. I mean, I think, so in my ideal world, like my sort of utopian world, the connection between those two battlefields would be that if it's possible to build solidarity and trust across what are, have been traditionally lines of difference at that local level, you know, the housing project, supermarket level, that kind of thing, then that becomes a resource for tackling the bigger policy issue, right? And I think part of the problem is the movement from one to the other is we're not good at kind of taking grassroots knowledge and converting it into the kind of knowledge that can impact a policy discussion. So, but if you can forge at the local level alliances between, say, people in the University of Penn and working class people who may not have a college degree or maybe don't even have a high school degree and so forth, then you have a space where you can actually join together expertise, the kind of expertise that works in the policy context, and local social knowledge, and begin to make contributions to a larger policy conversation. So this is where the internet and social media and new media are relevant. It's completely restructured the communicative flows that lead to messages getting to the sort of policy-making centers and expertise decision-making centers. And that's something that people can really take advantage of. So I think it's always been possible to form a connection between that local space of work and the larger policy context, but it's actually easier now. And it's something that people should take advantage of, if that made sense.
Yeah, just, I mean, it almost would imply, though, that we'd be needing to have those sort of superstructure conversations at those sort of project level, but at least in community development, we often avoid those larger conversations
right.
In sort of the, idea of expediency or just getting the project done.
Right. I see. That's very good. That's helpful. Yeah, that's a tough one because, I mean, sometimes it's true that if you open up the biggest question, it gets to be very hard to kind of work on the smallest question. Although, just speaking at a personal level, I'm sort of struggling with the same kind of question in that there are a lot. So take Ferguson and take the issue of, you know, should the police have body cameras or not, right? Okay, so we can kind of hash that issue out and maybe you think one thing or maybe you think another thing. But it's not really getting to the underlying issues that affect, you know, policing and so forth, and like our way we think about crime, the way we deal with crime, and that kind of thing, which fundamentally relate to drug policy in this country and sort of massive hypocrisies around drug policy
and employment policy.
Exactly. Yeah. So how? So I think you're right to point to there being a problem if you can't open up some of those bigger conversations as part of thinking about the local project, but I don't think I have any good advice at the moment about exactly how to make those things work productively in relationship to each other. I think it's very hard, but I think it's important.
When you were talking about the 99,000 people, I imagine in ancient Greece that that's a fairly static population, but when you make a circle around yourself today, that's the borders are much more porous of who's in that 99,000, who's not. Because people are moving in and out freely and being displaced, particularly maybe in a university context. So I was wondering how that mobility and porosity nowadays affects trust building within particularly, I guess, urban communities.
Mm-hmm. Well, it certainly has a big impact in any community that's connecting a university with a community, because that was like one of the first things in my experience at Chicago was, you know, you'd try to collaborate on something, and the first thing you get back was like, you guys aren't going to be here in 4 years, right? Like, we're going to live here. We're going to still be here, but you guys are going to be gone, so you know, why should we take you seriously? So I think it is a big issue, and so I think one has to be sort of self-conscious about working against that, and that can be a matter of, you know, sort of the, you mentioned the planning network when you started. I mean, sort of what are the kind of points of stability that can compensate for some of that mobility when you're thinking about partnerships. But I don't think it kind of fundamentally disables the concept of the project. What to say exactly? I don't think the sort of fact of fluidity diminishes what I take to be a kind of responsibility for citizenly behavior toward the people around us. And it doesn't seem to me it matters really whether our communities are stable or unstable with regard to whether or not the ethos that we establish within it at any, you know, day, month, year is egalitarian and democratic or not. I mean, we all want to, if we're going to move around, we would prefer, I think, to pass through communities that have established that kind of healthy ethos of egalitarian democracy. And so then if we think we would prefer to be able to pass through communities of that kind, then we have to help build them as such or maintain them as such when we pass through them, would be my view.
Hello, Professor Ala. I understand we are go-getter. I understand we are result-oriented. My question is more theoretical, more a little bit, you know, focus on that classic, you know, my question is simply about how to educate in the macro sense of education, in the sense of how to make a perfect human being, you know, the human being that would talk to that stranger,
right?
Because we have the liability of history, we have the liability that we know how to do it.
Right.
Think about it in the Jewish religion, for example. They tell their people, be good to the stranger. So, but in that context, the stranger is well defined, right? The one who is not Jewish is the stranger, and the one who, the active agent is the Jewish person.
Mm-hmm.
Now, Jesus Christ upgraded, and he says, love your enemy. He even make it more, he even makes it more difficult. And if we when I reflect upon it, you know, sometimes I think about it, what if Alexander the Great, for example, somebody told him, be good to the stranger, how his fight would have been handled? And sometimes I think about it more, and I say, how about if Plato would have lived a few years longer, and instead of having Aristotle teaching Alexander the Great, if what would have happened if Plato would have taught Alexander the Great, you know?
Right.
So my question is simply, how could we educate knowing what we know?
So the another comment I often get about my book is that I should have called it not talking to strangers, but listening to strangers. And I think that is, you know, at the core, the fundamental answer to your question. So, and I take that lesson in a certain sense, if one wants the kind of deep historical philosophical roots, from Socrates, who famously spoke to any and every person passing through Athens, which was actually more fluid. There were more strangers passing through Athens than you might think. And so for me, that's been the fundamental, you know, what have I personally gotten from my book has been this total revision of my orientation to strangers, such that every time I meet somebody I don't know, I'm wondering, what can I learn from this person? Like literally every single time. Street, again, anywhere, stores, anything. This person knows something about the world that is impossible for me to know because they're situated differently from me. How can I learn that? And that for me is the kind of beginning of a set of interactions that have been very rewarding and productive. That's just a personal.
There's also something interesting in his question about the role that, how we educate children. I mean, so much of the book concerns, do we protect children from the political? Do we actually immerse them and introduce them into the political from an early age? And
So I have two little kids, and so I do think about this and think about how do I raise them as people who will be comfortable talking to strangers. And so for one thing, you know, kids are, not all kids, but many, many kids are more comfortable talking to strangers than adults are, right? They'll just go off and run. And you watch parents over and over again, like pull them back and teach them to be safe, not friendly. And so, I mean, I've instead tried to make sure my kids, I always say, I congratulate them. I you know, pat them on the back, encourage them to say their name, to say hi and so forth. And at the same time, I sort of talk to them about, well, what are the circumstances where you can tell where something is safe or not safe and so forth. So I try to separate the two things so there's no damage to the instinct to be friendly and to interact with strangers, but also give them some analytical tools for thinking about safety. So that's one part of it. I mean, then there's a sort of bigger conversation about civic education in schools and so forth, and that comes to a few of these questions about how do you teach people agency. Right? I mean, fundamentally, like, how do you teach people that institutions are malleable, that they have control over them? And again, I think that's partly about, I mean, there's a woman at Harvard named Mira Levinson who's been working on something she calls action civics. She's in the ed school there. And action civics engages students from a very early age in projects. And to some extent, it's about their own school. Like, what would they change in their school? And then working with the teachers in the school to affect those changes. So they take their context immediately to hand and engage them in that. But then it is sort of lessons in the larger architecture of decision making, whether that's at the local kind of community level or the policy level. And how do you give people that education so that they can find the pathways through it and, you know, pull levers of change along the way? That's a bigger, much more substantial kind of education.
Yeah, going off of that, I come from Macedonia where I saw my mother talking to strangers all the time on the bus. So for me, talking to strangers was something very normal. And when you were relating to your experience coming to Princeton and how people were not saying hi, whereas in California you would say hi to everyone, I could very, very much relate to that experience. And as somebody who is concentrating in community and economic development, I find talking to strangers very important to our work. And I feel like sometimes people are not very comfortable talking to strangers, and they're in the field of community and economic development. So when people are like in their 20s, what can we do to teach adults? Because you were mentioning earlier about children, educating children early on. What can we do to educate adults about the importance of talking to strangers and being trustworthy?
I think that's a great question. And I think, you know, it depends on the kind of context you're talking about. So you've got, you know, work environments, you've got project environments like this one. And I mean, in all of these contexts, we're always teaching people what the kind of norms are, right, in that space. Sort of, what's the work ethic? Is this a place where people hang out by the water cooler and chat, or don't hang out by the water cooler and chat? So I think one just has to be self-conscious about how we are getting those lessons of interaction in those adult spaces, and then revise the lessons, basically. So in a university context, I think, you know, there are lots of projects that you could, there are lots of ways of building into the curriculum the opportunity for students to engage in the broader community. And what I think of as in knowledge exchange experiences, not service exchange experiences. And then if you can build those sort of knowledge exchange experiences with the broader community, part of preparing students for that is giving them sort of basic lessons about, you know, even just shaking hands and making eye contact and listening, asking yourself the question before you go, what can I learn from this person? And taking the time after you've had an interaction with somebody different from yourself to answer yourself for yourself the question, what did I learn? Because you begin to kind of make a record of the things that you've learned from people who are different from you, and it gets easier to see where the value is and to pursue the kinds of conversations that will help you learn from others. So, anyway, that was very abstract again. Sorry.
Is your question also like, how does one grapple with those that don't feel implicated by the social or the democratic project in a way? I mean, like, you're constantly talking about trust and distrust, but then there's also this specter of like one who has lost faith in democratic society, or one who doesn't feel that they are part of a social contract.
Right, they don't feel, this is not my problem. So back to the issue of mobility a little bit, students can pass through a place and think, this is not my problem, so I don't have to worry about it. I mean, something I've tried to do is make people more self-conscious about their own discomfort. So I think a lot of adults are uncomfortable around strangers. And so just plain drawing their attention to the fact that it doesn't have to be that way has, in my experience, been something that helps people be willing to try something else. Whether that's a matter of pointing to somebody else who's more comfortable and letting that person model for others, but just helping people realize you don't have to be uncomfortable, actually. There are whole lots of things you can learn to be better at this and therefore feel more comfortable. Nobody likes to be uncomfortable.
I was actually very touched by the way you talk about kind of a radical openness in your relational approach to other people. And I guess in terms of that, I have two kind of related questions, right? I guess one is on a more kind of personal existential level, which is how does this, you know, kind of meditative practice of talking to strangers becomes a habit and becomes something in a personal life that can help you kind of cast away angst in your own kind of personal existential way, and also in, you know, among your community, and therefore exert an influence around people, right? But then my second question also relates to, I would say, related to the kind of the kind of radicalness of this openness. There's a certain kind of anarchism in it. And I can definitely sense that kind of strand in your writing and in some of your thinking. So I really want to push some pressure on that point and see, you know, like where can this anarchism take us, or does it remain in a purely kind of granular level, or can it be kind of sublimated or transcended to a higher kind of institutional and power structure.
Remember, you're talking to a professor of government here.
That's a fantastic question. I mean, it comes back a little bit to the local projects versus macro policy questions and the issue of habits and institutions. So you are picking up in me a fundamental commitment to democracy defined first as constituted out of our relations with one another. So you're right, that is a kind of anarchic picture. It's not about representative institutions and stuff like that. But it's my conviction, and I can only call it a conviction, I can't call it a sort of evidence-based conclusion. It's my conviction that stronger democracy at that level would improve our political institutions. Partly because I think it would draw more solutions up into the political process that are built out of grassroots understanding of social difficulties, and partly because it would mean that there was a stronger body politic for politicians to be held to account by. I think one of our greatest weaknesses right now is that we are very bad at holding our politicians to account. And we can only get good at that again by strengthening this anarchic democratic stuff.